Write yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions, where we talk about the grassroots and what's going on and what are solutions to the problems, not just the dimensions of the problems. And today, we're going to continue a theme that we've been talking about for the past 6 months. And that theme is our American unions and workers at a strategic impasse. And we're going to welcome back a guest we had of a couple weeks ago on April 19th, Staunton Lynn, a well-known labor historian. And if you remember that show, if not, go back and listen to it, we ended up saying, well, we have to come back here and talk not just about the dimensions of the problems that American labor unions and workers in general are facing today, but we need to talk about specific solutions, specific ideas about what are we going to do about it. You know, we can talk all day about dimensions of problems, and we do that on this show, but we need to talk about solutions. I mean, people know that these are problems. It's not a big revelation that the American economy, for most of us, for example, is not recovered after 5 years. People know that. But what's the answer? What's the solution? You know, there's a lot of talk shows, and everyone's yakking about the problem, but, you know, not too much forthcoming in solutions. And if you read the media, the press, even liberal economists, in other words, others talk about the problems, but, boy, they sure shy away from talking about the real solutions. I'm referring, of course, to all this discussion about income inequality of late, which is fine, you know, but what are the solutions? Well, what we get from most of these folks are very tepid solutions like, let's do something about the education system, particularly the young children and so forth. That's fine. I'm not against that, but okay. Is that really going to solve the inequality problem in this country? Let's talk about a financial transaction tax on the big financial oligarchs in this country. But what about the fact that over 110 million working-class households are stagnant, are going backwards? What are we going to do about that? Oh, let's pass minimum wage. All right, so, you know, that'll have an effect on maybe 10 million. A little bit, not much, but doesn't really address the problem. Anyway, it's time to talk about solutions. What are we going to do about these things and fundamentally do about these problems? And one of these problems, of course, is the disappearance of American unions and labor. And my guest, Staunton Lynn, and I will talk about this some more here. You know, in past shows, we've had a series of very astute folks with a lot of experience. I purposely interviewing people who've been around a long time, seen things when they were different, and have therefore a historical perspective perhaps on how we got into this mess. And the mess is the strategies are failing all along the broad front for American unions and workers today. Organizing strategies, not just organizing the unorganized, but being able to hold on to membership, which is definitely in a downward trend, particularly in the private sector, but now also in public sector. Political strategies. You know, you look at organized labor, FL-CIO, Change the Wind, in major independents, put in about $400 million in the last election, 2012. $400 million before that to get Democrats elected, and what have they got to show for it? Absolutely nothing. The Democrats, of course, hide behind the Republican intransigence in Congress and use that as an excuse. So, of course, the Republicans are doing that. But I can't believe that legislative action is the only way around this. And we have industrial bargaining strategy, which is now at an impasse. You know, for 15 years, what we had was unions saying, okay, we'll trade wage increases for maintenance of benefits. In other words, we'll protect our health care and our pensions and so forth, and we'll trade off wages for that. In other words, we'll move the money from wage increases over to maintain our benefits. And union labor gave up a lot of wage increases, and the union non-union wage differential shrunk. But now that's coming to an end as well, as politically, these benefits are being undermined with health care legislation. Folks should realize that under Obama's ACA, Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, then 2018 union-negotiated health care plans will be slapped with a 40% excise tax, and that's the end of that, folks. No one's going to be able to negotiate 40% increase in these benefits. And the same thing with pensions. Pensions are collapsing all across the board. Defined benefit pension plans are disappearing. 401ks are providing absolutely no increase to those who hold them in terms of pension income growth. Pretty much stagnant. You can't get much out of that unless you want to invest in risky stocks, which you lose your shirt on. Industrial strategy, bargaining strategy is also at an impasse. And then there's the question of alliances. Labor, obviously, being so weak, can't resurrect itself unless it connects in a deep and fundamental way with the community and non-union progressive organizations, but it can't seem to do this. There was a little attempt last summer to maybe bring them into the FLCIO, but the more conservative unions slapped that down real quick, and nothing's really come of that. You know? So we want to do today is pick up this theme and start talking in reality what to do about this. And Staunton is the latest in a series of interesting interviews we've had: Steve Early, Ray Rogers, Jerry Gordon, Greg Shotwell, Boeing workers, others here over the last 6 months, and it's pretty important. Some of you may be very young and think that, union labor, they're not part of the action, and history shows that without organized labor moving in favor of change, social change, it's very hard for other groups to really have a big impact here. Common themes from our past interviews have been that, union labor workers are in a bona fide crisis. In an article I wrote, and I think it's on the PRN website, but you can get it at my website if you want to read it, here on May Day. I wrote an article on May Day called American Labor, May Day 2014, American Labor's Lament, and looked at a kind of a balance sheet of where we were today, where American workers are today. And just to summarize a few of those points before we get into our discussion, as sort of a benchmark of the crisis, real unemployment is still 14% when you factor in hidden unemployment into the U6 unemployment rate. We have a chronic long-term unemployment rate, millions of people, 36% of all unemployed are still long-term unemployed. We have population growing faster than we are creating jobs. We got people dropping out of the labor force because they can't find work, and older folks over 65 coming in record numbers because they can't afford not to work. We've got 110 million non-supervisory workers in this country, still 11 million jobs short compared to 2007. Yes, manufacturing, construction, higher paid jobs have not recovered whatsoever. The jobs that have recovered, 5 million plus, are mostly lower paid jobs, and the 5 million plus people who have left the labor force or not been able to find an entering labor force, making low paid jobs. So we're churning out high paid for low paid. We're churning new people and jobs and other people leaving the labor force at the other end of the tunnel. We got low paid jobs. We don't have quality jobs anymore. the real adjusted wage is less today than it was when the recovery began. Real median income, down about 10%. Labor share of income, down 6 percentage points, less than 50% compared with the 1980s. It's a long list. I mean, you cannot argue that there is not a crisis. There is a crisis, organizational crisis, and there is a crisis in terms of the results. So something needs to be done, and not a tweaking anymore. Tweaking won't do it. Tweaking, something fundamental has to be done. And fundamental changes have occurred before in the history of American labor. Maybe we'll talk about them. I know Staunton is well aware of them. But I think we have to discuss the organization question here for American labor. The current organization structure is part of the problem and is just not working anymore. And unless a fundamental change in how labor is organized and therefore its strategies, it will be more of the same, adrift towards oblivion. Okay, so I've had my say here for now. I'll come back and share some of my specific views on what I mean by organization change. But I want to turn it over at this point to Staunton. I've already coached him. I said, Staunton, come on the show. Today I want you to talk about specifics. What is wrong? What can we do about this?
Okay, but first let me second the motion from Brother Rasmus. I really agree with everything you've said. And turning to specifics, I think the big changes in organization have to do with strengthening what can happen locally and paying less attention to national leadership. Because if you think about it, go back to the early 1970s and think about movements like Miners for Democracy, the Sadlowski campaign in the steel workers, Teamsters for a Democratic Union. The common theme of all those efforts has been, wow, if we can elect new people at the top, everything will change. And it's clear that that was a mistaken view, because stay with the 1970s for a moment. What happened in the 1970s? American manufacturing began to move out of the United States to various low-wage locations, either in the Western Hemisphere or overseas. And looking back, it's just completely clear that the people who negotiated labor contracts from the end of World War II for the next generation assumed that, oh, steel manufacturing, that will always be here. Electrical components, that will always be here. Automobiles were the best car manufacturers in the world. And beginning in the 1970s, partly because cars, for example, could come in from overseas and were better quality and could handle the expense of sending the car here before you marketed it, partly because of that, but also because you could go to the U.S.-Mexican border or Bangladesh or wherever and pay poor, suffering human beings a tenth of what you did in this country. In other words, you could make a buck by leaving. And when American manufacturers decided that that's what they wanted to do, naturally people looked at the union contract, and guess what? There was nothing there to stop it. Number one, going all the, take the steel industry, because I have seen this language. Going all the way back to the very first contract with U.S. Steel in 1937, there was a clause that said all of the big decisions about the enterprise, shutting the plant, moving to a new location, are for management alone to make. The union has no voice. And unions signed on to that language because they said, oh, well, we're the best in the world. We don't have to worry about manufacturing leaving the country. And then when it turned out that you did have to worry about it, you asked yourself, well, what can we do about that? I mean, we did this in Youngstown, Ohio, when the mills started to close. And we filed grievances, we filed labor board charges, we pushed every button we could imagine. And what we found, of course, was that along with the management prerogatives clause, there were, I don't know any major CIO contract that does not contain a no-strike clause. And to the extent that they could, management expanded that. No strikes, no slowdowns, no interference with production of any kind. And, of course, since Egypt built the pyramids, the basic weapon of people who work for a living has been stopping work. So just think about it now. The companies wrote into the contract, they make all the big decisions. The unions agreed to say there's nothing we can do about it. And I think that's the basic problem, but I understand, Jack, that that's still not on organizing. And the way I would open up that discussion is to say, I think we've been too much focused on the national, on the election of new national leadership, and not enough on what workers are always going to desire and try to create, no matter what you or I or anyone else says, and that is strong local unions that make their own decisions and take their own direct action. And I think that if you look at things in that way, there are, in fact, things in labor law, things in contracts that give you some handholds. Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act protects concerted activity for mutual aid or protection. It doesn't say you have to have the approval of the national headquarters. It doesn't say that if you're less than a majority of the workforce, you can't do it. It says you have a right to concerted activity when and if you think it's appropriate. And if workers look around and don't see that today, it's because their unions have routinely given it up in contract negotiations. There's nothing in labor law to tell workers you can't strike. As a matter of fact, the people who wrote the Wagner Act were very concerned about this. And in Section 13 of the original Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act, they said that nothing in this law is to be interpreted to diminish or restrict the right of working people to engage in direct action, which means strikes, whenever they feel it's appropriate. And if that stuff is no longer available, it's not because Congress or the courts took it away. It's because union leadership gave it up. So I think that's a place to begin, direct action at the local level.
Okay, let me play devil's advocate with you then.
I'm listening.
strengthen your messages. We must strengthen local unions, which means the national unions, conversely, will have less control than they do now, which is almost total, over the local unions.
Right.
Okay. Yes, it's true that the National Labor Relations Act says these things, Section 7, so forth, 13. But the interpretation of these original statutes has drifted over a half a decade or more to a place where very clearly the interpretation is you don't have the right to strike anymore. And I would also say there's another area of interpretation that has developed since the 1950s, and that is given almost extreme power to national unions in contracts over their locals. I've been in unions where people were surprised to find out that the contract is really held by the national union, not by the local, which gives the national union the power anytime to override and to negate whatever the local decided, even if they decided not to do something or not to agree, then national can come in and sign the damn contract. You know, just last week we have an example of this in the Teamsters Union. The UPS workers, right, voted many locals not to approve the contract. Well, the national leadership wouldn't sign the contract anyway.
And as my friends in the Steelworkers Union here in Youngstown used to say, if by chance you reject a new contract, let's say, as they did at Boeing, the national leadership will just go on holding elections till you get it right.
Oh, yes. Well, that's been going on a long time. The Boeing workers, of course, we've had them on the show. They're shocked to find out that this could happen. But this is not new. This has been going on a long time. But even if they couldn't prevail, the national leadership prevail, as they have so far, and, well, they did in the contract with Boeing, you know, there's the nuclear option for them just to say, well, we don't care that you had a vote. We don't care what you say. We're going to cite it for the betterment of the union.
I had a friend who was for years president of the local union at Inland Steel in Northwest Indiana. And he told me there were situations where the entire bargaining committee of the local unanimously rejected a new contract proposal. And just as you say, Jack, the national union would say, well, sorry, we're the bargaining party. Look at the first page of your last contract, and we don't care what you thought. We're going to say yes.
Well, you know, this discussion can easily descend into a discussion that all the problem lies at the top of the national leadership. Then it becomes well, we need more democracy, union democracy. Yep. And while that's all true, you know, that really doesn't answer the fundamental question that you raise, and that is, how do we strengthen the local unions, notwithstanding this immense legal web that has developed over the last 5-6 decades, which the national union likes because it puts them in an incumbent driver's seat that's very, very hard to deal with. I think in the 40s and 50s, in the wake of Taft-Hartley and Landon Griffin, you know, this kind of tacit partnership developed at a legal level, and in which national unions sort of played it cool, national union leadership, in exchange they were given through a lot of court and NLRB decisions this power over the local unions. But the issue is not the legal. You can't solve this by legal issues. The issue here is, how do we strengthen local unions?
Well,
so
for
that
a
they
time,
can engage
let,
in
let
independent
me,
action.
Yeah, for a time, I was the education coordinator of the big Teamsters local in our area, and I learned to my surprise that local hired its own organizer. Usually you think of organizers, well, they are all employed by the national union, and that gives the national union one more handle in dealing with the local. In this case, we had a lot of other problems, but I thought it was a very good idea that the local union, if it's a large local, if they have some resources, should hire its own organizer. And in fact, you extrapolate that thought, you could have two not-so-strong local unions, and they would hire somebody between them. So that's one small step.
Let me throw an idea out that I was going to hold to my later discussion.
Okay.
Rather than local unions hiring their own, which that's been a practice for larger locals for quite some time, and their local, by the way, digression, tangent here, local organizers always perform far better in terms of organizing than people sent in from the national union.
Yeah.
I mean, those people from the national union are worthless usually. And it's the local people because they know the local issues and they're
exactly.
part of the local
exactly.
issues and they're more effective. Anyway, but that's a digression, right? Instead of the local union hiring local people, which the national union still has power over, why wouldn't local unions form organizational structures with local community groups and jointly hire people so that local community group, a labor community kind of organization, which is not totally under the power of the national union and the National Labor Relations Act and all this legal web, begin pursuing joint interests, including contract issues and interests, outside the formal legal web that is built up here today.
Well,
we
think
need
that's
an organizational
a terrific
structure.
Idea. I think it's a terrific idea, Jack, and a variation of it. We had something in Youngstown, you know, I don't want to exaggerate, but for 20 years, we kept alive something we called the Workers' Solidarity Club. And the genius of this thing was that you had people from all different kinds of workplaces, some unionized, some not, but, you know, teachers, steel workers, nurses, etc. And I think it had the same freedom of action that you suggest. It was in fact, we called it a parallel central labor union because, you know, central labor unions, of course, differ from one place to another. But in Youngstown, people would go on strike in July and snow was falling before they got any help from the central labor union. And that practice of you do one kind of work, I do another kind of work. When you guys go out, we join your picket line. When we go out, you join ours. That was the way people did things in the early 1930s because there was no AFL-CIO. There was no National Labor Relations Act, and so it was horizontal self-help at the community level. Not just in the big general strikes that we all know about, Toledo, Minneapolis, San Francisco, but little places. I had a friend from Barberton, Ohio that nobody ever heard of, and that was exactly how they functioned. They had about six different kinds of manufacturing, different local union in each one, and they would simply all go out when any group of workers was on strike and forming a picket line. So I think that's a variation of what you're talking about, because it does bring the community dimension in, simply in the sense of many different kinds of workers. And just as you say, it creates an entity that a single national union cannot derail just by, you know, turning the faucet handle.
Right. This kind of organization, which would be an organization, solidarity center or something like that organization, would be able to pull together the best, most militant, aggressive workers from various unions into it, and also the best community organizations and leaders together, which are all workers anyway, one kind of another, you know.
In the kind of community we're talking about, absolutely.
Yes, and it would be independent of this legal web. You see, the legal system has evolved in the post-war period, and especially lately. So it is a total limitation on workers exercising their rights. It does not help them anymore. It's there to constrain, and prevent them. I would say most of the national leadership is complicit in that kind of a structure because it's in their own personal interest. But if you could create this local solidarity center organizations where you could bring together the best of both people with unions and people without unions and community groups and have it independent, it would not be, I mean, the whole question of the right to strike would have no relevance in that kind of organization because it's outside the the Labor Relations Act. It's outside that structure, and it brings together the most militant people who would be the leading edge of this structure.
And I'd like to add something to what you said, Jack, in that radicals of all kinds, I mean people who are open to new ideas, people who are fundamentally committed to the rank and file, worry a lot about, well, how can we get working people to think in terms of class solidarity rather than just, you know, the interest of the people on my midnight shift at the place where I work. And I used to just sort of glory in the fact that we'd get together, we'd put the chairs in the circle, and you didn't have to talk about class solidarity or any of this because the truck driver would look across the circle at the nurse and say, "My God, we've got the same problem."
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very important thing, that you want to organize in a way that broadens people's sense of a working class, of, you know, the 1% and the 99% and so on. And doing it in this way, you don't have to have booklets, you don't have to talk people's heads off. It's right there in the way you're organizing.
Right, you don't have to teach working folks about solidarity because they already know it without having even to spell it. You know, that's kind of an intellectual's talk about why isn't there more solidarity in the labor movement? You get solidarity from people acting together, not
exactly.
By talking to them.
Exactly. But Marty Glaberman used to have a wonderful story. Marty Glaberman worked in auto shops in the Detroit area, and he said, "You're at your machine, okay? You see a group of people coming down the aisle, and you say to yourself, too many people just to be going to the materials room, not the right time for lunch. You turn off your machine, you join the procession, and when you get outside, you say, okay, what the hell is this all about?"
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You act first.
Right, right.
You act first.
Let me throw out another controversial idea, and that is that you don't need to give up contracts in doing this.
No.
Creating this kind of independent organization with a foot within the organized labor movement and a foot outside of it and independent of the forces of control. You don't even need to sign a contract to have a contract. In other words, what I'm saying here is that we think that collective bargaining, you know, and the end result of a contract where you sign an agreement, you can have a contract without signature. In other words, you can have an agreement between the workers and their employers without having to sign a contract. And a lot of that goes on anyway, where labor is strong at within the shop and so forth. A lot of agreements between management and labor exist without signing a contract on them.
And
so you can have this solidarity center organization And it could make demands upon employers and upon local governments, you know, and upon whoever else is opposed to workers' interests. And under the threat of we're going to do something about a boycott, whatever, you might get agreements that might not even need a signature.
And if I could just add something to that splendid idea. For example, in big electrical shops in the Pittsburgh area, in effect, they bargained in an IWW manner because they would consider problems one at a time. And then you could nail up on some conveniently situated bulletin board, today, so-and-so, so-and-so, the company and its workforce agreed to do a particular thing. And you don't have to think of bargaining as something that results in, you know, a 600-page roadmap to anything that might possibly happen within the next 100 years. You can deal with issues one at a time.
But I would stress that people don't, who are discussing on this show, we've had interviews and so forth, aren't stressing enough the organization question.
Mm-hmm.
They rely on a kind of a spontaneous labor community alliance idea.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't have staying power. I think you have to have some kind of form of organization to have staying power.
Yeah,
otherwise,
if only for defensive purposes, as you point out, because rather than a particular union being able to put you in trusteeship, hey, how do you put a parallel central labor union in trusteeship? You can't do it.
That was my previous point, right? It's outside this this legal web
that has
labor and workers tied in knots today.
Right.
They can't do anything, which means all they can do is rely on leaders to do something for them. Well, that's not a union anymore.
That's right.
Okay, let me give a little historical background comment on this, okay? It seems to me, if you look back in the history of American labor, there have been periods in which the organizational structure used at the time failed to deal with the new challenges. The new challenges, of course, being changes in the nature of capitalism and business and corporations and so on and so forth, right? If you look way back, Civil War, post-Civil War period, Knights of Labor, a certain kind of organizational structure that doesn't exist today, more of a self-help kind of a thing, you know, insurance and so forth, for folks who may not be interested in the history here. That collapsed. That collapsed under the pressure of the 19th century depressions, massive depressions in the 1870s, 1890s in the U.S. That form of organization could not prevail. What came out of that is the American Federation of Labor, the craft union in the 1880s, 1890s, which could survive a depression because it was built on skilled labor.
Right.
But the craft union approach could not deal with the industrialization of America industry. And that required the formation of the CIO in the 1930s, which
mm-hmm.
was a response to industrial America. So again, the form of organization, AFL organization is different than Knights of Labor, CIO is different than AFL. Of course, CIO is pretty much defeated during the McCarthy era and runs under the umbrella of the AFL, and they form an alliance, which was never really very comfortable between the two wings.
Right.
But the CIO form of organization, industrial America form, no longer, AFL-CIO, can no longer succeed in, as you pointed out, a global capital and capitalism in the 21st century. So another form of organization, I believe, now is on the agenda. And, you know, whatever that is, I have no secret bullet what that is. We talk about the local a little bit, as we are. But I believe labor must fundamentally change its structure in order to change its strategy in order to have a strategy that can deal with the attacks that are now driving it into oblivion. What do you think of that?
Well, I'll just make a few comments, if I may, about the excellent capsule history that you presented. In 1905, people, discontented people with AFL craft unionism got together in Chicago and formed the Industrial Workers of the World. And it was originally a very broad collection, from Eugene Debs to the metal miners out west and so on. And they made the assumption, Jack, and if you go back and read the documents, it's just quite clear that if workers could only have an industrial form of organization, you wouldn't have to worry about radicalism. These people would all have the same expiration date for their contracts. They would strike together. It would be a new day. And I think what we learned in the 1930s was that, there's a good deal in that argument, but you can have an industrial form of organization that's controlled from above and that's not radical in any way. And that's what John L. Lewis had created in the miners, and it's what he made to happen to the best of his considerable ability and bankroll in the CIO. And so you had in the miners' union itself, people in southern Illinois who said, nah, we don't want John L. Lewis's union and approach. We want to have something which they called the Progressive Miners of America. And he crushed it. He crushed it. So industrial unionism in itself, that is, all the people who work in a given workplace belong to the same outfit, it's necessary, but it's not sufficient, it seems to me. And you're beginning to suggest ways that we can have a kind of industrial organization that's different from what we've had since the 1930s.
Yes, I don't think it's going to work simply for existing unions today who are being hammered in manufacturing and so forth, but now into the professional services too, being hammered by globalization, which is really nothing but capital moving abroad and setting up operations. That's what globalization is for labor. I don't think the solution can be for the steelworkers simply to negotiate a partnership of some kind with the German metal workers. I don't think that is capital moves much faster, and that's too slow. It's still down from the top, right? I think there has to be something else. What else is that? I don't know, but we should damn well have a discussion on it. A serious discussion with people who have been around for a while, who are independent of being paid by the national leadership. There needs to be a conference of sorts where local leaders, community leaders, and union leaders who are independent and want a solution get together and start talking about, as a first step, what kind of new structure can we have? Should we have? Whatever. We don't even have a discussion. There's a little discussion that occurred by the AFL-CIO a couple years ago, but it was very top-down. Who knows what got edited on their website, etc. Totally insufficient discussion. People need to organize the discussion themselves, I think.
And, Jack, doesn't it seem to you that's a challenge that particular metropolitan areas could take first cracks at? In other words, it doesn't seem to me that you need to wait until some group of geniuses like ourselves has projected a national something or other. It seems to me that particular communities could experiment, could say, well, here's how we tried to do it, and here's what we might all learn from that, and so on.
Absolutely. It has to come from below. You know, anything that comes from above, from, you know, let's have a conference and form a new political party, or that's all nonsense, you know.
Yes.
And whether it's in labor or outside of labor or political groups or whatever, it's got to come from below, or it ain't worth a damn.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk some more, though, about this solution thing. Before I come back to, because I want to let listeners hear what my vision is to begin this discussion, but you know, you're my guest here. I want you to continue. You made this excellent initial point about we got to find a way to strengthen local unions somehow, organizationally, non-organizationally, alliances, I don't know what, but that is a principle here, and to do so independently, not trying to reform the labor laws, which you're not going to get, or somehow reform democracy within the union, the national union, you know, out of control power over local unions now, but independently. Okay, that's an extreme important point you make. Now, give me another one. I'm not going to let you go with just one idea.
All right, here I come. In Youngstown, your idea of worker and community joining together was something we reached out for because the whole damn steel industry in Youngstown used to be second or third producing area for steel in the United States. There is not a single ton of steel being produced within the city limits of Youngstown, Ohio today. So we had this catastrophe, and we formed an alliance essentially of local unions and community groups. Like, for example, there was a ministerial alliance, and they joined in. And we brought a lawsuit. I was the lawyer on behalf of the Worker Community Alliance. Now, our problem was that every ton of steel being made in the Mahoning Valley, that's the area that includes Youngstown, in the 1970s, was made in open hearths. It was made with an obsolete technology. And we had enough going that I think we could have garnered the $20 million necessary to buy any of the big mills. But what we couldn't find a way to get was the $200 million necessary to put in basic oxygen furnaces or electric furnaces. In other words, we were defeated by the fact that we had the fickle finger of fate had given us one of the most capital-intensive industries in the United States, and we just couldn't get the money together. But it seems to me that with smaller kinds of enterprises, people shouldn't be afraid of the idea of worker community ownership. Why not? And there was plenty of interest. Guys wanted their jobs back no matter what it took. And if it had been the Sultan of Saudi Arabia coming over the hill, they would have said, yeah, that's a great idea. And therefore, I think we have to challenge a small group of financiers and industrialists making all the big decisions, and at least in kind of medium-sized enterprises begin to say, well, we'd really rather run that ourselves. If it doesn't make enough of profit for you, get lost. As long as it breaks even, that's enough for us.
Okay, that sounds to me like producer co-ops.
That it wouldn't be just producers. It would also be the community that you have emphasized.
With community involvement. Okay. Two comments on that from my part. One is you have to have an ongoing organization to push that kind of a solution. It can't be done just spontaneously, company by company. But secondly, I'll be honest with you, I'm not a big proponent of producers co-ops. For a whole number of reasons, we can have another show on that. I don't think that's the direction that necessarily people should go in.
Mm-hmm.
But let me, in what remains, throw out my vision here.
Okay.
And have you comment on this. And I'm going to see if I can put this organizational chart for a new structure for organized labor up on the PNR Network website here and on my own website, if I could scan it. And we'll see where this goes. This was a thought I had 10 years ago. Change the wind emerged at the time, and it was the great hope, in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, we had an attempt at reform in 1995 that didn't go anywhere, but did produce one strong thing, and that was AFL-CIO finally turned towards immigrant workers after 1995.
Yep.
2005, there was great hope to change the wind, the Teamsters, laborers, and others would break away from the AFL-CIO,
mm-hmm.
which they did, and would form something new, which they didn't, showing that, the whole change the wind thing was really, we don't want to pay dues to the AFL-CIO, or we have a personal problem,
mm-hmm.
personality problem with some of the leaders,
Yeah.
So it was everything was at the top. It wasn't really fundamental, although that was the hope. But in the wake of that, I tried to develop something in my first book, The War at Home, The Corporate Offensive from Reagan to Bush, published in 2006, what I thought might be a starting point for discussing a new form of organization for American labor here, which incorporates some of the discussion that we've just had. But let me just describe this to you. Fundamentally, it starts with this idea we were talking about, that you got to strengthen independent local unions, and you somehow have to merge them in an ongoing way in terms of activity with community organizations as well. I call these local mobilization committees.
Mm-hmm.
And the local mobilization committee would have two full-time paid organizers, one selected from the union members, excuse me, and one from community organizations,
mm-hmm.
right? And their job would be to coordinate and lead inter-union and union community mobilizations in support of organizing, strikes, boycotts, campaigns, protests, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was important that this not be a total organization challenge to the AFL-CIO. Somehow this has got to be a extension of, but not an alternative to, the Central Labor Councils, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what are the functions, then, difference between the local mobilization committees and the Central Labor Councils? Well, let the Central Labor Councils do what they're doing anyway, right? Their job is really to interview candidates and do all these other things, give strike support, which is tokenism and so forth, or what I call typical cope, hope, and dope activities.
Say that again.
Cope, hope, and dope. In other words, cope, Committee on Political Organization, hope, which is, donations and stuff like that, City of Hope, and other dopey stuff. Okay. So, but the connection between the Central Labor Councils and the local mobilization committees is that the labor councils would elect the organizer for the local mobilization committee, but the community groups would elect their own.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so but this would be the very very local structure, like across several labor councils in a urban area, particular metropolitan urban area as we have today, right? One local mobilization committee across those labor councils and several labor councils, and the best, most militant people from the unions would join the local mobilization committees, would be the elite of organized labor, and you would also have the elite from the community organizations participating equally in this with two paid organizers, one from each sector. you got to have an organization, and you got to have people who get paid so they don't do it on an ad hoc basis, that they're doing it for a living. Okay. Now, this would roll up to a higher regional level. There would be what I would call American Council of Unions, that would be composed of these local mobilization committees. The American Council of Unions would be regional. Their primary mission would be focusing on activities at the point of production. In other words, organizing, strikes, supports, boycotts, and so forth. They would pretty much be the higher level coordinator of these local mobilization committees. Higher up for the labor councils, at one structure level up, would be what I call American Federation of Unions. This would be involved with activities like job search and training, administration, electoral activity at a state or national level, and so forth. In other words, coordinating a central labor council specific functions. Functions would have to be defined specifically and differently. One's at the point of production, and one's political and administrative, you might say. But then we get to the higher level, and that is the structure that you have now in the AFL-CIO Council, National Council, would have to really change. And that structure, you know, is a stovepipe structure, independent unions and so forth. It's a very, very loose form of federation, which doesn't work because it's hard to get the unanimity on action. What we really need is for labor to develop at the national level what I would call a executive function and a legislative function. We need an American Workers' Congress of members selected both from the regional American Council of Unions and Federation of Unions, i.e. the point of production and the not point of production part of the activity of labor. This would be a delegated body, right, that would meet quarterly. No executive authority, but a policy-making direction strategic determination authority, which then the AFL-CIO would have responsibility to implement. And again, the activity at the point of production would be our mobilization committees and regional councils of unions, and the activity at the political level would be the Federation of Unions and the Central Labor Councils. But the important point, in addition to local independence and an organizational structure outside the legal web in which best union militants and the best community militants could function. We've talked about that. At the very top, we need an American Workers' Congress where the legislative direction and the strategy is developed, but developed not based on the 15 or 20, quote, leaders of national unions in the back room, but developed out in the open, delegates sent there by the regions and the local unions. Anyway, that's a thought.
And, the only comment, Jack, that I would offer in the very short time left to us is that I have had some experience with community organizations. I was part of the first faculty of Saul Alinsky's Industrial Areas Foundation Training Institute, and most so-called community organizations in the country are on the Alinsky model, and I have a lot of questions about it from my own experience. So for a discussion at some point in the future.
We need to have a further discussion, Staunton.
Well, yes, and we need to try to make this happen in a couple of particular communities.
Agreed.
I think that's the first step.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Okay, this is Alternative Visions. We'll see you next week. I'm hoping to have some national leaders on from the Green Party to talk about the presidential report here on climate change. So come back next week.
Sounds good.